Michael Billington, thank you very much for coming in to talk to Theatre Voice this afternoon. We're talking about your career as a critic, as a theatre critic. Can I ask firstly, when did you first have an inkling that you would like to be a theatre critic? Was it when you were quite young?
Rather frighteningly, when I was at school, I began to get the urge to write about the performances I'd seen. It's partly because of geography. I was brought up near Stratford-on-Avon, about 8 miles away, so that meant at the age of, 13, 14, 15, 16, I was regularly cycling the 8 miles from Leamington Spa to Stratford and seeing these amazing performances by people like Laurence Olivier and Peggy Ashcroft and Michael Redgrave, etc., in these great plays of Shakespeare. So I felt I had to go home and write something about this in an exercise book. And then once you start, you don't stop, and one just goes on doing the same thing at university. I mean, like many people, I acted in plays and directed plays, but I also wrote for university newspapers and magazines. And I began to discover something that I only felt really happy when I was sitting at a desk with a piece of paper or behind a typewriter, writing about what I'd seen. I was a terrible university actor. I was probably a worse director. And I'm not saying I was any great shakes as a critic, but I began to feel fulfilled in writing about other people's performances and productions. And then you leave university and you face this awful dilemma, what do I do? No one wants to employ you as a critic.
What did you study at university, I suppose?
I studied English, which again, if studying English at Oxford has any virtues at all, and that is somewhat debatable, its great virtue is that it teaches you how to be a theatre critic, because you're forced to condense all your knowledge, all the accumulated knowledge of 3 years, into a series, as you well know, of exams where you have to write under a fierce deadline. And everything you know about Beowulf has to be crammed into one paper that takes about an hour in the final examinations. In other words, you learn to write against the clock to compress your thoughts and to express what you feel about these great works of literature. So I felt that degree helped me make up my mind that that was really what I wanted to do, write reviews.
And were there a number of critics that you admired at the time who were writing and who inspired you to cherish the profession itself?
There was one huge influence on my generation. I mean, I was at university in the late 1950s, early 60s, and that was when Kenneth Tynan was the Observer theatre critic, and for all of us, he was the icon, really. Because he made the theatre every Sunday sound, glamorous, exciting, urgent and necessary. And he also had this slightly sexy charisma. He was a tall, rather striking figure in purple suits. One looked at him occasionally when he came down to university with a kind of awe. And he was the model. This is not to diminish Harold Hobson, who was then the Sunday Times theatre critic, and who I think history will be kind to, because Harold Hobson was the person who saw the potential in writers like Harold Pinter and Edward Bond and many others, when Tynan sometimes didn't, to be truthful. But Tynan was the role model for all of us.
You didn't don a purple suit at any point? You didn't act the flamboyant critic at any point?
No, but one thing I did do, and I've hardly ever revealed this, I earned my first £5 as a theatre critic by writing a parody of Kenneth Tynan, which won a competition in The Observer, where you were asked to parody any of the regular features of the newspaper, and that was my first appearance in a national newspaper, I think, parodying Tynan. My enemies and some of my friends would say I've been doing it ever since, of course.
So what can you just talk us through your progress from university onwards then? Did you start writing for a local paper at that point?
Well, I went straight into a trainee course in journalism in Liverpool, which I was a total disaster. I won't spell out the details. I did every single thing wrong you could do as a trainee journalist. A friend said I was the lucky Jim of provincial journalism, and I left after 6 months to their relief and mine, and took up a job with Lincoln Theatre Company as a sort of PR, basically. It was called Public Liaison Officer, but that's what it meant, trying to find an audience for this rather splendid repertory theatre. So I worked in the theatre for 2.5 years and ended up directing some plays. Came to London in 1965 looking for work as a critic and as a journalist, and found it very difficult. But two things I would say saved me, really. One was the existence then, it does still exist now, but more tenuously, I think, of a magazine called Plays and Players, which in the 1960s, edited by Peter Roberts, was a bumper magazine that contained a whole wealth of reviews, feature-length reviews, and I started writing for Peter Roberts. First show I ever saw was a Ken Campbell play at RADA called Events of an Average Bath Night. It wasn't any good, but at least it got me going. And the other thing was an individual patron. There was then an arts editor at the Times called John Lawrence, who made a habit of looking for young critics, and he would read student newspapers to find the next generation of critics. And John Lawrence gave me my first go as a critic on a national paper in 1965, reviewing St. Joan at Bristol Vic. And it was his constant encouragement and constant employment of me that sustained me and convinced me I might be able to do this job.
So you became a sort of fully paid up critic at some point in that.
I became a sort of utility man, I suppose, on the Times, in that I was deputising for the theatre critic, who was then Irving Wardle, deputising for the film critic, John Russell Taylor, and then doing television reviewing, and then started to do interviews. So I was sort of a utility player, anonymously, I hasten to add, because in those days there were no bylines on the Times, so no one knew who the hell you were, but at least one was actually writing almost every day of the week in that newspaper, and it was just a fantastic opportunity. And because of that individual, I should say that he also appointed Irving Wardle as a Times drama critic. He gave John Peter his first venture into criticism. You know, he was a great patron of all of us. We all cherish his memory. But because of that man, I've always tried to look sort of kindly on young people in the same position as I was then. And when people do write to me asking advice, I always do try and reply, because I know what it's like to be hungry to be a critic when there's no one employing you.
It's often seen as a very fickle profession, generally, journalism. Did you at that point imagine that this would be a job that you might have a good shot at while you were young and then move on to other climbs, or did you have a sort of career plan as such once you've got that first foot in the door?
In those days, I mean, at one stage I thought perhaps I could be a director of plays, and I was in love with the Royal Court and wanted to work there, but I realised I wasn't good enough and never would have been. So that went out the window. I suppose the only other dream I entertained in the 1960s was working in television. And I thought, could one balance these two things? Because television in the 60s, unlike today, was extremely exciting. I mean, there were very good arts programmes like Monitor, very good current affairs programmes. And television, again, had a glamorous excitement about it, which I don't think it quite does now. So I thought, could I perhaps combine the role of some kind of cultural commentator with some kind of pundit on television? That didn't happen. I mean, I worked spasmodically in television, but never consistently. And in the end, I'm quite grateful that I didn't pursue that route. No, I didn't have a long-term goal. I just knew that I felt comfortable writing criticism, and that if I had any thing to contribute at all, it was via that. It was via comment rather than participation in the theatre. I didn't imagine that I would be, as I am now, 64 years old and still working on a national newspaper. I would have been delighted, I suppose, if I'd been told that at 26 or 7, but I didn't envisage it quite happening as it has.
Mm. You say that you felt more comfortable in this role as an analyser of other people's work, in a sense, and one of the judgments that's often passed on critics is that they are somehow lesser beings because they're not the creative ones, they are the ones who are analysing and passing judgment themselves. I mean, is it something that troubles you or has troubled you at any point that in some ways you are a passive spectator, although obviously your skills are hugely active?
Well, I know the argument, and we all do, and obviously it would be wonderful if we were all endowed with the gifts of Chekhov or Ibsen or Osborne or Pinter, you know, and could write plays, or if we could act or direct, but I think you quite simply have to fulfil whatever limited talent you've got in life. And I decided my only talent was as an analyst rather than as a participant, as I say. But I would also go further than that. I actually do think I'd rather be a halfway decent critic than a rotten actor or dramatist. I mean, just to take an obvious example, I would much rather have written Bernard Shaw's dramatic criticism in the 1890s than have been a walk-on in Henry Irving's company at the Lyceum, or indeed one of the dramatists who wrote those dreadful plays that Irving did at the Lyceum. I mean, in other words, Shaw's criticism seems to me art in a way that the ephemeral plays of that period mostly were not art. And I think criticism is, at its very highest level, and I'm not claiming that I'm on that level, but at its very highest level, is comparable to art in that it has to have music, rhythm, structure, poetry. It has to be something that is worth preserving and worth reading, you know, 50 years on, and the very best criticism, that is true. So I don't feel at all ashamed of being a critic, and I don't regard it as a sort of second best profession. As I say, we all do what we can do, and the only thing is to try and do it as well as you can.
Mm. You joined The Guardian in 1971. And in those days, this was the heyday, well, still the heyday of Fleet Street.
Mm-hmm.
And you landed the lead job, is that right, in 1971?
Yes, it came about because I had been writing for the Times for 6 years. Philip Hope Wallace, who was the very, very, very distinguished drama critic of The Guardian then, was increasingly unwell, couldn't go to the theatre 4 or 5 nights a week, and they were rather desperate for someone to step into his shoes. And Peter Preston, then editor of The Guardian, had been an editor of mine at Oxford and knew me and knew my work. That's not, I think, I hope that's not why I got the job, but he did at least know who I was. And asked me to step in. And I have to say, I was terrified because, and rightly so, because Philip Hope Wallace had an awesome reputation and a huge following amongst readers of The Guardian. There was Neville Cardus writing on music, Philip Hope Wallace on theatre, and here was I, this puny whippersnapper, whom no Guardian reader knew from Adam, stepping into Philip's shoes. And I think it took me many, many years to overcome, if I ever have, the hostility of the readers, or resentment, not hostility, resentment of the readers, because I wasn't the man whose voice they had got used to. And that, of course, is always a problem with critics who occupy a space for a long time, and who am I to say this? But it makes it a bit more difficult for the person who comes after.
And joining The Guardian, did that finally align your own political persuasions with your employer, as it were, your employment? Was The Guardian the paper of your destination, in a sense?
Yes. It was a happy marriage, quite honestly, between my my views on theatre and on life in general, and the paper. And I think it's very important that. I think newspapers have to cast their critics carefully, and if you miscast a critic against the grain of the newspaper, then it soon shows, and often the critic doesn't last. It doesn't mean there is a Guardian line on everything, and I've never, ever, ever, ever been instructed as to what to write, or what political line to take, and the Guardian actually is quite a broad church, but it obviously it encourages liberal views. And so I've always felt comfortable writing for that newspaper, and I just feel very lucky to have written all those years for the paper that I would automatically read. I'm a great believer in this, actually. I think one should always do things that one would, as a consumer, enjoy. In other words, I think as a principle, one should only appear on things like radio programs that you yourself would choose to listen to, and otherwise you're always in trouble.
Do you think that The Guardian in particular has more of a crusading agenda, and that as a critic for The Guardian, that your role is perhaps slightly different to those of other papers, possibly, where you're recommending plays that have, for one thing, perhaps more of a political emphasis, or at least plays that could engender some kind of change? Do you think that's your a slightly different brief to those of the other critics?
It's never been spelt out in so many words, but it's true that I have campaigned all my life to the point of boring the pants off my readers, or reader, for plays that deal with public issues and public agendas, and I always find plays of that kind much more exciting than narrowly focused domestic plays, and that is perfectly true. But that's my instinct rather than a Guardian line. It just so happens, I suppose, it is the kind of line which The Guardian itself would endorse. But one thing strikes me, I mean, looking back, not in any anger, at the way the job itself has changed. Because when I came to the business, the job of the critic was to go to the theatre and write about plays. That's fairly obvious. But now the critic has to do, and all of us, I think, have to do many other jobs as well. We are interviewers. We're often economic commentators on the plight of the West End. We're having to stand back and survey the state of theatre all the time. We write obituaries more and more. I appear quite often, and so do other arts journalists on The Guardian, on the news pages with increasing frequency. I welcome this, but it's very interesting how the job has broadened much more from being an aesthetic play taster into a kind of social and political commentator on the state of theatre in general.
Carol Wardis rather mischievously suggested on our website recently that most theatre critics, or in fact all critics really, should hand over after 10 years. She thought that there was a tendency amongst critics to get tired, or at least doing the job a lot was quite fatiguing. Do you think that there should be a time limit for critics?
Obviously not. No, I don't. I think it's up to each individual to decide. There are critics who blaze like comets with a certain brilliance and then go on to other things. Kenneth Tynan, whom I mentioned, was a good example of that. He only did 9 years, I think, on The Observer before moving on to be dramaturg at the National Theatre. Other critics, James Fenton, also in Times, and came and went very quickly because he was, you know, a different kind of writer. There are those of us, and I think it's quite a large number of us, Benedict Nightingale, myself, John Peter, who are there for the duration, as it were, or as long as people want to employ us. I don't get bored with the job for the simple reason that the theatre seems to me as inexhaustible as life itself. Theatre is only a reflection of the larger world, and if you are bored with theatre, in some sense it may be a comment on your boredom with what is happening around you. And I find any week in the theatre fascinating because of its variety. You're not dealing with any one thing. In any one week you might be dealing... I mean, this week, let us take an example. What have I seen? I've seen a play in Stratford East about racial identity. I've seen, as it happens, two American plays about America's role in the world. But I've also seen a review about Jesse Matthews, famous 1920s musical comedy star. And all weeks are like that. Some weeks are even more varied. You know, you're going from Sophocles to Anything Goes to a contemporary play, often within the space of 3 or 4 days. Irving Wardle once had a good phrase. He said, all critics are quick change artists, and that's what we are. And that in itself keeps me reasonably fresh.
Mm. You've been fortunate in many ways to have a career that coincided with a number of bursts of great energy in the playwriting scene, particularly in this country. Do you think that it's part of the reason for your longevity as a critic is that you have been a commentator upon the careers of very important playwrights in this country and that you've been in a position to oversee their development?
I think it's true. I think I've been extremely fortunate. I mean, critics in the 40s and 50s were lucky because they were writing more about great acting, I would say, than they were about great writing. I mean, that was the era of those famous giants we've mentioned. But I feel incredibly lucky because when I came in 1971, obviously certain writers, Osborne, Pinter, John Arden, were established, but there was a whole generation that was just embryonic, as it were, or just getting going, and it was a generation of David Hare and Howard Brenton and Howard Barker and Carol Churchill. And I feel I've been sitting on the sidelines writing about those careers for the last 30 years, and happily most of them are still there, so they haven't gone away either. I've also coincided with Andrew Lloyd Webber, which has its ups and downs. It's a very interesting question because I find one's relationships professionally with these writers also goes up and down. David Hare is a very good example of a writer whom I've, on the whole, championed for most of his career, but there are some Hare plays lately that I've not found so exciting, and David Hare is not afraid to let one know this. He's a classic example of a writer to whose new play I always go in a state of high expectation.
Do you have any regrets as a critic about plays that you misjudged or playwrights indeed that you neglected or failed to spot?
Yes, I mean, who wouldn't? Who doesn't? I suppose the most obvious and famous recent example is Sarah Kane with Blasted, which burst upon us in 1995, I think, at the Theatre Upstairs one cold January evening. And I think, in common with almost all my colleagues, I misjudged that play. And I only dealt with its obvious sensational aspects, its violence, its sexuality, and what I didn't begin to perceive was that she was a writer writing from a moral basis. Very interesting, as a footnote to that, I had a conversation to this effect with James McDonald, who directed that production some years after, and he said to me, Michael, stop feeling quite so guilty. He said, I directed the play and I don't think I got it right either, because he felt he hadn't linked the two halves of the play sufficiently. He then redirected the play at the Royal Court Main Theatre and did a brilliant job, and the critics, myself included, all responded to the play. But tragically, Sarah Kane by then was dead, so she never saw our repentance. But yes, of course, there are individual writers and individual plays that one has misjudged, and there are other plays that one has overpraised and have disappeared without trace. Mm. But that's part of the risk of being a critic.
Mm. Do you always feel that it's a case of a tightrope walk between serving your reader and actually also in some way serving the playwrights and the artists involved?
Yes, I do. I think it is a tightrope walk. Someone once said to me rather unnervingly at some public discussion, whose side are you on, ours or theirs? Meaning, you know, the punters or the theatre people. And I don't see it like that. I don't see it as a sort of battle between these two giant forces. Obviously, one's responsibility is to one's readers and one's editor and the newspaper that employs you. But I do feel a sort of ungovernable responsibility towards the medium as a whole and its future, in the same way that I would argue anyone who wrote about football would feel that you've both got to be realistic and honest about the game you've just seen, but you also have a commitment to the good of the sport. I think theatre critics are just like that. We have a divided responsibility.
What would you say to somebody who said, how do I become a theatre critic? What would your advice be to them?
Stick at it, go to the theatre, and get into print. This is always my final point. Get into print somewhere. It doesn't matter whether it's the Church magazine, the Gardener's Gazette, the student newspaper that you happen to be at university with. Whatever, get into print, because only by getting into print will you convince your next employer that you've got something. And when people write to me and say, I'd like to be a critic, my first instinct is always say, well, show me something. Show me some work that you've done, preferably published, and then I can judge your capacity. But you can't just become a critic in the abstract. You've got to prove it. Mm. And you've got to have a portfolio of work to convince people, I think.
Yeah. The critics in this country, and you must be numbered, I suppose, amongst this group, are sometimes described in hostile terms as sort of white, middle class and male. Do you think that your race and your class and your gender are key factors in the way that you approach drama? Do you think they're unavoidable factors in the way you view things?
Well, they are unavoidable. One cannot help but be what one is. I've been conscious of this for a long time, and that not only white middle-class male, but also white middle-class males coming from much the same educational background. There's a strong Oxbridge in-lit element in British criticism. The only good thing I can say is that's beginning to change. I can see some evidence of that. And the most single important change is there are many, many, many more women critics than when I started. When I began, there was some superstition that women didn't do dramatic criticism, they did film criticism. But drama criticism was against the sort of rhythm of their domestic life. They didn't want to go out five nights a week. I mean, obviously, this is bunk. And now, there's any number of very good and vibrant and lively women critics. Many of them, actually, in the Sunday newspapers, for example, on a Sunday, you know, you can read Susanna Clapp in The Observer, or Georgina Brown in The Mail on Sunday, or Kate Bassett in The Sunday Independent. My own deputy, Lynn Gardner, obviously is a woman, and very, very conscientious and good critic she is. So that has changed. I don't think you'll never get a situation where the critical fraternity or sorority or body is representative of the country as a whole or a microcosm. I don't think that's how criticism works. It is an obsessional activity, and not everyone is prey to this peculiar obsession. But I do think it is changing and should change.
And this question refers a little bit back to the advice, but it's also a question generally about criticism in this country. Do you think that we should have more technical understanding and training in the job as critics, that we tend in this country to kind of be thrown in at the deep end and try and work our way through it from there? Do you have any feelings about our training as critics?
Well, I mean, I'd never be one to knock academic qualifications for any job, but I do believe ultimately that criticism is a self-taught business. I was talking recently to a Moscow graduate who told me she was doing a five-year course in theatre criticism, but 5 years is a long time to spend on this subject, even if you're studying the whole history of theatre. And by the time you graduate, you're going to be a veteran critic. I think there's a lot to be said for being thrown in the deep end, and given the structure of our society, it is a journalistic activity, not an academic activity. We're writing for newspapers, and we have to learn how to express ourselves quickly, hopefully entertainingly, and concisely.
Well, you've done that this afternoon. Thank you very much, Michael Billington.
Thank you, Dominic, very much indeed.